Welcome to Dig, a history podcast.
In 1937, a man named Page Harris was interviewed at his home for an oral history project. The interview was part of the federally funded Works Progress Administration, an aspect of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal designed to provide federal jobs to a wide variety of workers while also bolstering or preserving aspects of American culture. In the interview, Harris recalled his experience growing up as an enslaved child on a farm in Maryland. The farm was called Bloodhound Manor, so named because the man who owned Page raised and trained bloodhounds that were used all around the South to track enslaved people attempting to run from bondage.
Harris was a little child when his master, Mr. Stafford, freed his family, but family stories had kept the memory of the dog breeding operation clear in his mind. Stafford might have as many as 100 dogs on the farm at any time. He trained the dogs by having an enslaved person run along a set course, then jump up into a tree. Guided by a more experienced tracking dog, younger dogs would learn to track the scent, then bark at the base of the tree until called off by their handler. According to Harris, Mr. Stafford's dogs were often sought to apprehend runaway slaves. He would charge according to the value and the worth of the slave captured. His dogs were often taken to Virginia, sometimes to North Carolina, besides being used in Maryland. I have been told that when a slave was captured, beside the reward paid in money, that each dog was supposed to bite the slave to make him anxious to hunt human beings.
In another interview that same year, a woman named Mary James recalled that the plantation where she grew up on the James River in Virginia had a high rate of runaways. The patrollers were many in the county, she remembered. They would whip any black person caught off the place after night. Dennis Sims, who was born on a tobacco plantation in Maryland, recalled that, quote, "Sometimes Negro slave runaways who were apprehended by the patrollers, who keep a constant watch for escaped slaves, besides being flogged, would be branded with a hot iron on the cheek with the letter R."
These stories are abhorrent, and they seem foreign from our 21st century experience, centuries separated from the immoral practice of enslavement. But if you look closer, something in these stories is uncomfortably familiar. Each of them is an example of the work of slave patrols, the police force of the slaveholding South. Further, each story suggests that patrollers weren't just used to find runaways or check travel passes, but that they used violence to punish and deter others from bad behavior. These are stories, then, of police brutality. In this final series, six C's of historical thinking, we are considering the concept of continuity. We're much more accustomed to thinking about history as the study of change over time. But we must also consider the ways in which things do not change, or maybe how they shift and morph in their details while staying largely consistent. In the United States, police brutality is, unfortunately, a constant. The contours and context change, extra-legal violence at the hands of law enforcement does not. Today, we're talking about the long and in many ways unchanging history of police brutality in the United States. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Marissa.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
Friends, we couldn't have come this far or kept at it if it wasn't for you all, our listeners. We're thankful for all of our listeners, new and returning, overseas and domestic, student in college or student of life. We're especially thankful for the patrons of this show who funded our presentations at conferences, the new equipment we're recording on right now, and our endless book needs for research. A big thanks to our fabulous auger and excavator level patrons, Hannah, Carl, Colin, Denise, Jessica, Edward, Lauren, Karen, Iris, Susan, Maria, and Lisa. We can't thank you enough. Listener, if you're not yet a patron of this show, it's easy. Just go to patreon.com /digpodcast to learn more. Also, we wrote a book.
We wrote a book.
Woo! We Four Podcasters wrote a book, and you can pre-order it from Three Hills Imprint of Cornell University Press. See our website for more details. The more pre-orders we have, the better.
Yeah.
And it is about spiritualism, and it's we decided to write about this based on the success of our spiritualism episodes. So
yeah. And it's really good, you guys. We worked really hard on it.
Yeah, I think it's good.
Pre-order it. You want to read it. I promise you. You want to read it. As always, we want to start by acknowledging our sources for today. The stories that we gave at the top of the episode all come from the Federal Writers Project, that WPA program that we mentioned. Thanks to the Library of Congress, all of those oral histories are digitized on the Library of Congress website, which I have linked in the transcript. So you should just be able to click and open that up. And they really are worth browsing if you're interested in that sort of thing. I also relied on the work of many historians, such as Monica Munoz Martinez, Sally Haddon, Tyler Wall, and Jared Layton. I also used a recently published volume called The Rutledge History of Police Brutality in America, edited by Thomas Aiello, which features something like 40 chapters on various different kind of slices of time, slices of American society, and how they relate to policing and police brutality. And I found it to be a really fantastic resource. It's very readable. Each chapter is not super long, but super detailed and very well written. So as I refer to those individual chapters throughout the episode, I will try to name check the author. But also, of course, all that information is in the notes and bibliography as well. And so if this episode piques your interest in this topic, I do highly recommend checking out all of these texts. I was really impressed. Everything that I read was really impressive and compelling.
Because this is an episode focused on continuity, it could be hours and hours long to accommodate every region, time period, and community. So we'll be looking at case studies across time and place to explore the ways in which police brutality has not changed over the centuries. Let's start in early America with a basic introduction to policing in the United States. The British colonies in America adopted the British system of law enforcement, which relied on the buy-in, so to speak, of all of the men in a particular community. In medieval Great Britain, communities were divided up into smaller groups called tithings, which constituted 10 families. The men in these tithings, over the age of 15, pledged to come to the assistance of another family in the case of emergency or crime when they heard a call for help. This was called the hue and cry. Each tithing was headed up by a man, the tithing man, who organized the response. Then, of these tithings was 100...
I know, it's a lot of, like, very weird words, and and they seem sort of obvious, right? Like, 10 tithings is 100.
Right. Yes. And 100, these all come from, like, medieval, like, census taking, like, from the Doomsday Book and stuff like that. That's how, like, they, like, organize.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So the 100, this came under the authority of a man called the Shire Reeve, or as we better recognize it today, the sheriff. The sheriff could call up the 100 to serve as a posse comitatus, which was essentially a police force gathered up in times of need. This, of course, the basis for the term posse, which comes to have the connotation of a vigilante law force. In some ways, this early form is kind of like that, in that they weren't formally officers, but at the same time, they were recognized as official, whereas posses in our current use refers to unofficial attempts to seek justice. So kind of note that slight difference there.
Yeah, and if I can interrupt, we'll also see throughout the episode and over time how posses remain vigilante, but that they also continue to have, at least in some ways, the cooperation or the authority of recognized law enforcement or organized law enforcement, either formally, right? Like they're like, we're going to work with a posse, mm-hmm. or in that they don't stop the posse. Like they allow the posse to do their thing.
Right. They're collaborating in some way. This is actually interesting because, sorry for this aside, but it's kind of interesting to me. I teach immigration history, and one of the big events that we talk about is the Latimer massacres. I don't know if you've heard of these, but it's basically there was like these Slavic coal miners who were kind of agitating for some labor rights in Latimer, Pennsylvania, and they were just peacefully marching. And the story goes that the sheriff and his posse came to Latimer and someone opened fire and they massacred all of these Slavic workers. And whenever I tell this story, I'm always so annoyed by the sheriff and his posse, because my students are like, what do you mean the sheriff and his posse? He has like some random followers that are his buddies. And it's like, well,
yeah,
you know, but it's an example of like how in this time, this is in the 1890s. So it's sort of like, you know, there is some slippage between these vigilante groups and official law enforcement.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really good example of what we'll see throughout the episode, actually.
Right. And this gives me the good vocabulary to explain it to my students, because I'm usually just like, yeah, you know, the sheriff and his enforcers. You know, it's like hard to explain, but this gives me the good vocabulary for that. So the Latin phrase posse comitatus meant the force of the county or the force of the region, indicating that even though the group was temporary, they were official and worked at the behest of authorities, going all the way up the chain of command to the king.
The American colonies adopted the same tradition, but often organized a system where cities might have a paid position of constable, then consider all of the able-bodied men in the area the police force. Most colonies had militias populated by those same able-bodied men, which meant that they did receive some amount of training and drilling for discipline. They sort of were a twofer, right? They were the militia and a potential posse. Still, it wasn't really understood as a job as much as a community duty. In most northern cities, like New York, for instance, militias essentially were the law enforcement. They served as night watchmen and were expected to report in case a posse comitatus was summoned. And a posse comitatus could be called up for any number of reasons, from fires to attacks from wild animals to crimes to like rowdy drunks, right? Like they just basically were all of the first responders. But as cities grew and population soared into the 19th century, this ad hoc system no longer worked. In the 1840s, New York City created a formal professional police force. Each ward within the city had its own police district, who still watched for fire and warded off wild animals, but also tried to prevent crime. This is often referred to as the Peel or Bobby system, named for the British politician Robert Peel, who pushed through the Metropolitan Police Act in Britain that created the system in that country, which then northern states used as a model to create their own systems. And I did not realize this. This is where I learned that this is why police officers in Great Britain are called bobbies.
Yes, right. And then we just copied them because Britain is our mommy.
Exactly. Yes.
So the South, though, maintained the reliance on community policing using the posse comitatus in part because of the need for all white men to present a unified front against enslaved people. According to historian Glenn McNair, quote, for a criminal justice system to be considered legitimate, all had to be bound by its rules and all had to be protected by them. Slaves represented the principal threat from which whites had to be protected, so they would be ruled and policed by force, not through their voluntary cooperation, end quote. The race-based policing that existed in the South, in other words, defined who was a member of the community and who was a threat. The logic of slavery also by necessity informed policing, in particular its reliance on violence to maintain. James Henry Hammond, one of the absolute ghouls of the antebellum slaveholding South, wrote in response to critiques of slavery's violence, quote, Critics complain that our slaves are kept in bondage by the law of force. In what country or condition of mankind do you see human affairs regulated merely by the law of love? Unless I'm greatly mistaken, you will, if you look over the world, find nearly all certain and permanent rights, civil, social, and I may even add religious, resting on and ultimately secured by the law of force, end quote.
Another slavery apologist, the wacko George Fitzhugh, wrote that, quote, physical force, not moral suasion, governs the world. And that because of this, quote, the Negro sees the driver's lash, becomes accustomed to obedience and cheerful industry, and is not aware that the lash is the force that impels him. This logic was carried to its furthest extremity in punishing enslaved people who tried to escape or who committed crimes. A South Carolina law in 1712 called for the intentional disfigurement and disablement of those who tried to run away, including branding, cutting off an ear, castration, or cutting the Achilles tendons. In Virginia, repeated runaways could have one leg amputated. Some slaves were also executed by hanging or burning, and in some states, their mutilated bodies used to deter potential runaways. These were horrific punishments meant to send a message to other enslaved people, but they were most often implemented after an enslaved person had already been brought to justice. In other words, these were the punishments sanctioned by a local judge or justice of the peace. Most slavers preferred to maintain their investment in a bonded person and used punishments that were less deadly. And if I can add just really briefly, I do want to say that these really brutal punishments were also used against enslaved people in northern states as well. Around, I think it's in the 1720s, a slave uprising in New York City is met with very similar, I think, public burnings of some of those people involved. So this is not, at least in this time period, in this moment, not just a southern thing.
With this in mind, while southern states continued to use the system of sheriffs and constables to enforce laws among whites, they also added on slave patrol in the mid-18th century to specifically enforce race-based laws known as slave codes. Patrols were usually pretty small, ranging from about 4 to 7 men, but with the expectation that, as with the hue and cry for a posse comitatus, all able-bodied white men would come when summoned. This was especially critical in the case of a slave uprising. Slave codes heavily regulated the mobility of slaves, for instance. One of slave patrol's main daily tasks would be simply checking the passes that enslaved people would carry for authorized travel. In addition, all white people, whether they were formally on a slave patrol or not, were authorized to check passes, or break up unauthorized gatherings, return enslaved people to their owners, or to a justice of the peace, and even mete out punishment. One South Carolina law read, quote, if any slave who shall be out of the house or plantation where such slave shall live or shall be usually employed, or without some white person in company with such slave, shall refuse to submit or undergo the examination of any white person, it shall be lawful for any such white person to pursue, apprehend, and moderately correct such slave. And if any such slave shall assault and strike such white person, such slave may be lawfully killed, end quote.
Patrollers were always expected to return runaways or slaves without a pass to their master or a justice of the peace for punishment, but they were authorized to exact their own punishments. Most patrollers carried weapons, whips and ropes, but also firearms. One formerly enslaved man named Sabe Rutledge recalled to a WPA interviewer that his uncle Andrew had one of his eyes shot out by a patroller while trying to escape. More often, though, patrollers used painful and damaging but not deadly methods, such as whipping, and used their guns only to intimidate. And as we sort of suggested before, in some states, such as Virginia, patrols were required to bring a captured slave to a justice of the peace before they could whip them. In others, though, such as the Carolinas, there was no such requirement, and patrollers exacted whatever punishment they wanted. In some cases, contracts laid out expectations for patrollers. In an 1856 contract in Salisbury, North Carolina, a man named Horace Robards was assigned captain first class of a patrol for the month of January by the county clerk. And I think this is interesting because it suggests, it kind of backs up that idea that, like, this was a duty of all of the white men in the community of a certain class. And so, like, this guy is only the captain first class for the month of January. Like, it's a rotating assignment, right? The contract, while outlining the captain's duties and leading the patrol, also authorized patrols to whip enslaved people up to 15 times as long as they were in the presence of the captain. They could deliver further blows if they had permission from another authority, such as a judge or the slave's owner. In the event they killed an enslaved person while they were trying to catch or punish them, in some places, the owner could be reimbursed by the local government.
Patrollers were also authorized to raid slave cabins to check for banned items or break up unauthorized mass gatherings. One enslaved woman named Charity Bowery explained to abolitionist Lydia Marie Child what this was like. Quote, "In the course of my conversations with this interesting woman, she told me much about the patrols, who, armed with arbitrary power and frequently intoxicated, break into the houses of colored people and subject them to all manner of outrages," end quote. These cabin raids placed enslaved women at particular risk as white men forcefully entered intimate spaces. One enslaved interviewee recalled that sometimes after they whipped enslaved men, sometimes patrollers raped their wives. Not infrequently, patrollers made it clear that they enjoyed both the power and violence of their work. Patrollers waited outside churches to catch people they knew didn't have passes to go out. Night patrols timed their rides at odd times to ensure enslaved people couldn't rely on a pattern. In North Carolina, one patrol regularly visited between one and three cabins a night. While most of these visits took place on evenings when slaves had freedom of movement to visit family, usually Saturday and Sunday nights, Sally Haddon found that a third of their visits were randomly spaced throughout the week. And some slavers disliked having patrollers around, whether irritated that they had a tendency to inflict physical punishment, thereby damaging the labor potential of their property, or because they considered them uncouth, rowdy, and socially inferior.
Slave patrols were tasked with keeping the everyday order, enforcing slave codes, checking homes and breaking up gatherings, meting out small-scale punishments, whatever the mood struck them. And of course, they were used to catch and return slave owners' property when enslaved people ran away. But the real intention behind all of this was the suppression of potential revolts, creating and maintaining a culture of fear and constant surveillance over enslaved people to prevent that they never try to rise up. But when revolts did take place, the normally tiny patrols of 4 to 7 men were bolstered by militias and posses. After the Nat Turner uprising in the summer of 1831, white patrol units strengthened by enraged and terrified white men from around Virginia and neighboring North Carolina called up for posse service, summarily and indiscriminately executed dozens of enslaved people without trials or even without investigation, assuming their general guilt because of their race. Henry Brown, who famously escaped from bondage later on by putting himself into a large box and essentially mailing himself to abolitionists in Philadelphia, just an incredibly incredible story. I said an incredible
story. We're smart, we swear.
We are smart. It was an incredible story. It was incredibly incredible. But Henry Brown, before he does all of this, recalled in his memoir that in the aftermath of the Nat Turner uprising, quote, "many slaves were whipped, hung, and cut down with swords in the streets, and some were found away from their quarters after dark were shot. Great numbers of slaves were loaded with irons. Some were half hung, as it was termed. That is, they were suspended from some tree with a rope about their necks, so adjusted so not quite to strangle them. And then they were pelted by men and boys with rotten eggs." He's remembering this as, I think he was a boy when this happened, and sort of seeing this crackdown and not really understanding what it was in reference to. And then only as an adult realizing that it was in reference to Nat Turner's uprising. In one case after the Nat Turner uprising, a white patrol was about to kill an enslaved man named Hubbard when a white woman who had survived the uprising intervened. Hubbard, she said, wasn't part of the rebellion, but had actually helped her to survive. And I mean, this is good evidence for the fact that patrollers just didn't care for the details, right? Extra legal killings by patrollers and posses were so widespread after Nat Turner's uprising that militia head General Richard Epps had to issue a general order asking citizens to, quote, abstain from any acts of violence to any personal property.
The property being enslaved people.
Exactly, exactly. Slave patrols may seem distinct from police to us now, but while the bobby system often gets credit as the basis of policing in the United States, historians of policing slavery argue that slave patrols were perhaps even more foundational to creating the American system of law enforcement as it exists now. Today, patrolling, just sort of being constantly present, driving or walking around in a community, is central to modern policing. Patrolling is, in its essence, just constant surveillance. According to Glenn McNair, it is inconceivable to think of modern policing without officers on foot or car patrol, but the first Americans to do so were on horseback riding the roads and fields of the South to keep whites safe from the enslaved blacks in their midst. And so I think it's really important to consider that, like, American policing is not just based on the bobby system. It's like, yeah, the bobby system is part of it, but the slave patrols also set a really powerful precedent.
Right. And that's how, this is how a lot of American culture is. Yes, it is based on something British, right? Like English common law or whatever. But then there is this peculiar context in the Americas where we have large amounts of enslaved people.
Right.
Right. And that necessarily means that that system is going to be adapted to the needs of our particular society. Right. Which are different than the needs of a society where there were some enslaved people in Britain. Right. But in very, very small numbers and not entire plantations. And like slave revolt is not really a concern. Right. So obviously
it's going to be sort of integrated. It's integrated into the larger policing system. Yeah, I just think it's really important to add here that we can, I think, really easily fall into the trap of thinking that slave patrols are something distinct and something unique to slavery, to the time of slavery. But Glenn McNair really powerfully argues that this wasn't just about, I mean, obviously it was attached to slavery, the system, but that the sort of policy is not quite the right word, but like the tradition of this constant surveillance just gets updated. Like it just morphs enough so that it is no longer called a slave patrol, as we'll talk about as we move forward, right? It just becomes updated during Reconstruction, and it changes a little bit so that all of the precedent of slave patrols, that constant surveillance, that kind of active policing is still with us, right? And that's not part of the bobby system.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's probably a hard truth for some police officers and police departments today to kind of grapple with. So they probably just don't.
After emancipation, while the legal system of enslavement no longer existed, it was replaced by the reign of terror known as Jim Crow. States passed black codes that replicated the old slave codes, especially concerning vagrancy and mobility, designed specifically to ensure supervision by white bosses and to control black people's ability to move about freely. These laws were race-specific and were often vague or arbitrary, making it illegal to do things like mischief or make insulting gestures. Black codes also required that black men show proof of employment. While justices were supposed to oversee the enforcement of these laws through trials, typical sheriffs or other lawmen wouldn't bother going through those steps, instead exacting justice themselves. This changed during Congressional Reconstruction, when federal military presence and congressional oversight meant a repeal of black codes. But in 1877, when Reconstruction formally ended, most went back into place, nicknamed Jim Crow laws in reference to the popular minstrel character. White supremacy was enforced by vigilante groups, most famously the Ku Klux Klan, but also the Order of the White Camellia, and other smaller paramilitary groups known as rifle clubs. Such groups used intimidation, terror, and violence to enforce racial hierarchies.
But the existence of such groups did not mean that formal policing didn't also continue to exist. And indeed, like slave patrols, work alongside white posses and vigilante groups to control the black population with the use of or the threat of violence. In New Orleans, in the late 19th century, police acted with complete impunity against black residents, even in cases where there was no indication of a crime taking place. In a story that comes from historian Adam Malka, police locked up a woman named Emma Robinson in 1884 because she was running down the street and wailing after learning about her father's death. In 1886, another woman, Eliza Williams, was violently attacked by a police officer who saw her sitting on her own doorstep, even after she explained that it was her own house. In 1887, a black man tried to report a robbery to the New Orleans police, only to have the officers beat him instead. Southern police officers, not unlike Klansmen, also summarily killed black people. A man named Colonel Murphy shot and killed a black man named James Weiss because Weiss observed and then followed Murphy while he dragged another black man into a police precinct house, sort of observing this, right? A South Carolina constable named Eisen shot a black man named Jim Long after Long had stolen a bag and attempted to run away. His justification was that the gun had just gone off unexpectedly. Two Alabama officers shot an unnamed black man in the back after they burst into his home while he slept to accuse him of stealing $5. But police and vigilantes also worked in concert to exact justice against black people. In 1896, for instance, a black man already in the custody of the police was shot by a white man who approached the scene. Police did nothing to stop the killing, nor did they pursue the white shooter afterwards.
Other police groups in other regions and time periods used incredibly similar tactics as slave patrols long after emancipation. As historian Maria Munoz Martinez argues, quote, despite popular assumptions that vigilantism in the 19th century occurred primarily in regions where law enforcement institutions lacked structure and social influence, vigilantism was in fact practiced in places where criminal justice systems were well established, end quote. Judges and jailers allowed prisoners to be taken from jails, and law enforcement officers encouraged and took part in lynchings. At the same time, extralegal violence at the hands of the police is often not interpreted as lynching, even though that's exactly what it is. During the period between 1910 and 1920 in Texas, Martinez has found, quote, law enforcement officers, soldiers, and vigilantes claimed the lives of hundreds more ethnic Mexicans. Estimates of the number of dead range from as few as 300 to as many as several thousand, end quote.
Take, for instance, the so-called Bandit War of 1915, in which Texas Rangers led a series of raids against Mexicans and Mexican-Americans who they believed were rebels. While white Texans saw this conflict as evidence of the Texas Rangers effectively protecting the border, ethnic Mexicans saw it as a race war and massacre. Within this context, Antonio Longoria and Jesus Bazan had several of their horses stolen from their ranch, along with some supplies. The two men had to decide whether or not to alert authorities. If they did, the bandits could come back and seek revenge. But if they didn't, they could be accused of supporting the bandits. They finally decided to report the robbery to the Texas Rangers. They met with a ranger named Henry Ransom, who listened to their story. According to witnesses, the two men then rode off towards home. But the rangers that they had just talked to waited until they had ridden a few hundred yards away, then followed up behind them in their Ford Model T. When the car was close enough, one of the rangers reached out the window and shot both men in the back. The rangers then left their bodies there on the roadside and even came back a few days later to warn neighbors and witnesses not to move the bodies. Ransom explained that he wanted the bodies to stay there to, quote, intimidate all who witnessed them. The bodies remained there for weeks before a friend worked up the courage to remove them for burial. And the murders went unremarked in Ransom's official reports, and the coroner never issued death certificates, and this was more or less ignored by the local press.
The murders of Jesus Bazan and Antonio Longoria happened amidst white Americans' anxiety about the Mexican Revolution, a protracted and widespread war that took place between 1910 and 1920. In response to residents' call for greater military presence along the Texas-Mexico border, the population of soldiers in the region rose sharply from about 300 in 1913 to about 100,000 in 1916. Combined with messaging in newspapers, the military presence heightened panic about encroaching, quote, border Mexicans. Military presence wasn't enough to ease the minds of white ranchers, who petitioned for more and more Texas Rangers to also police the border. Between 1913 and 1915, the Texas government poured money into the Rangers, and the force swelled from about 13 in the entire state to 1,350 just a few years later. The force was given more or less carte blanche authority against any ethnic Mexicans in the region. In fact, the governor had, quote, given Captain Henry Ransom instructions to go down there and clean it up if he had to kill every damned man connected with banditry or theft, end quote. The result was essentially ethnic cleansing of the region. To quote Maria Munoz Martinez, the Rangers, quote, profiled any ethnic Mexican as a Mexican bandit and made arrests and then left prisoners vulnerable to mob violence, end quote. Anyone could be a bandit if the Rangers wanted them to be, and they used methods that helped reinforce easy assumptions about a victim's guilt. Rangers relied on something called la ley de fuga, or the law of flight, to retroactively prove a victim's guilt. They made certain to shoot men in the back so they could later justify the killing by arguing that the suspect had tried to flee. A Texas resident living in the area during 1915 said that bodies that had been shot in the back by the Rangers were regularly found left in fields and that, quote, nearly every day you could hear about people's being killed by Rangers, end quote. We have that episode about Antonio Rodriguez, too, about the violence against ethnic Mexicans. And I think we also mentioned the story of Antonio Gomez, who was younger, I think. But they're both similar circumstances where, you know, they were lynched and law enforcement, you know, turned the other way.
Yes.
Or collaborated. Yeah.
Right. And I believe that Elizabeth and I consulted the same book. Maria Munoz Martinez talks about those two cases really powerfully. And just as an aside, like, that has to be one of the most powerful histories I've read in a while. Like, this book is really incredible, and it's very readable. I think even by somebody who's, you know, doesn't read a lot of history books, I think it's very approachable and very readable. And one of the things that I thought was really powerful about it was that she talked, like, she inserts herself in and like living people into the text. Like, she doesn't shy away from those sort of modern connections that people have to these murders, because really they weren't that long ago. Mm-hmm. Like, people's grandparents were alive.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So she tells a story about the descendants of Bazan and Longoria. Like, I think it's the great-granddaughter or something. Like, the circumstances under which she learned about their murders and sort of how she then sort of had to grapple with that as a Mexican-American person living in Texas, like, sort of in modern day. Mm-hmm. It's just really powerful.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So the ranger who killed Bazan and Longoria, named Henry Ransom, developed quite the reputation for summarily killing Mexicans without evidence of their committing a crime, let alone their, you know, having a trial. When Mexican raiders derailed a train, rangers rounded up 10 men. They had no evidence that any of these men had actually been part of the raiding party, nor did they make any effort to go through the justice system, and just killed them almost immediately. Then the rangers, assisted by local police, rounded up several more men. The local sheriff later recalled that Ranger Henry Ransom invited him to take part in killing the men, saying, quote, I'm going to kill these fellows. Are you with me? The sheriff refused, and Ransom then accused him of, quote, having no guts. The sheriff retorted, that takes a whole lot of guts. Four fellows with their hands tied behind them. It takes a whole lot of guts to do that. The sheriff then left to investigate whether two of the arrested men who he kept with him, like he takes two of them off with him, had actually taken part in the raid. He conducts an actual investigation and he finds that they were innocent. They were not involved, and he releases them. But by the time he returns to check on Ransom and the other men, Ransom had killed the men that were remaining in his custody. The sheriff was actually so concerned about Ransom and his sort of proclivities that he actually went to the governor of Texas, James Ferguson, to complain. Ferguson replied, quote, "Ransom will make you a good man if you warm up to him." To quote Martinez again here, quote, "The systematic killing of ethnic Mexicans without criminal trials signaled the collapse of the Texas judiciary into the reckless collaboration of civilians and state officers who executed subjects at will. This was, essentially, an official sanctioned practice of the state of Texas."
Right. And that story kind of tells us that, like, not everyone was on board with this and thought it was okay at the time.
Right.
You know, like, a lot of people will say, oh, well, it was a different time back then. And it's like, no, even back then, people were like, no, this is not okay. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But the powers that be were like, you know, just let it slide, that kind of thing, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important point.
Right. Police utilized violent mobs to assist them in policing racial hierarchies around the country. In Los Angeles in 1871, police interpreted an interpersonal disagreement between two Chinese men as evidence of crime and violence within the city's Chinatown. To extend their manpower, historian Stephanie Hinerschitz writes that they deputized a mob to search Chinatown for criminals, quote, "forcing residents out of their homes, setting fire to their businesses, and expelling them from the city, but not before lynching 18 Chinese men," end quote. Chinese communities formed tongs, which were more or less like gangs. Initially, these were sort of like benevolent societies, but over time, more like criminal gangs, offering protection to certain businessmen for kickbacks, for instance. Gangs are obviously not ideal, but they were a reaction to the lack of protection and law enforcement from white police officers. Tongs provided business owners an added layer of protection from mob violence and police raids.
But the creation of tongs only raised the official police sense of threat. The San Francisco police, for instance, created a Chinatown squad devoted solely to surveilling Chinese men suspected of being in tongs. These cops wore plain clothes so as not to arouse suspicion and enforced tiny infractions, things like obstructing the sidewalk or washing a balcony at the wrong time of day. This was a real crime in San Francisco. And this was done in order to disrupt Chinese communities. Think of this as broken windows policing, right? The squad regularly raided private homes and businesses, smashing private property without evidence of crime. Police also issued more widespread, sweeping raids. In 1925, after a tong murder raised police concern about gang activity in Cleveland, Ohio, the police used it as an opportunity to essentially clear the city of its entire Chinese population. Cleveland Director of Public Safety Edwin Berry ordered the city's police to, and I'm going to use the language in the original quote here, to arrest every Chinaman in the city of Cleveland. Police rounded up, without exaggeration, nearly every Chinese person in the city, arresting 612 of the population of 700. Berry argued that this was necessary because, quote, "it's no use questioning them because they can't talk English, but they know who did the killing, and every Chinaman we can get our hands on is going to stay in jail until the slayers are turned up." How the Cleveland police would be able to figure out among this huge number of prisoners who the murderer actually was, wasn't clear. And of course, that wasn't really the point. It was to send a clear message that Chinese people were not welcome in the city of Cleveland.
Police also used violence to police political radicals and dissenters. In 1886, during a labor rally outside of McCormick Reaper Plant in Chicago, a fight broke out between striking workers and strikebreakers. Police then fired indiscriminately into the crowd, killing several workers. August spies a labor organizer who had been speaking at the rally used the clash to further mobilize strikers, saying in a circular distributed to strikers, "Working men to arms, your masters send out their bloodhounds, the police. They killed six of your brothers at McCormick's this afternoon." Later, spies stated that, quote, "I knew from experience from the past that this butchering of people was done for the express purpose of defeating the eight-hour movement," end quote. Local anarchists answered the call and organized another rally, this time in Haymarket Square in Chicago. The Chicago police showed up, marching in as if they were a military unit, and demanded the crowd to disperse. At some point, someone threw a homemade bomb into the gathered police, killing at least one officer. In response, the police opened fire into the crowd of gathered protesters. The demonstration descended into a melee, resulting in the deaths of at least two more police officers and three protesters, and wounding dozens more. After Haymarket, the police relentlessly pursued anarchists, raiding newspaper offices and arresting over 100 people without warrants.
Police response to political radicals intensified during the socialism panics of the Red Scare in the 1910s and 20s, and again in the era of McCarthyism or the 1950s. Empowered by the Immigration Act of 1917, which granted power to deport any non-citizen for being associated with anarchism, and the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917 and 1918, which made it illegal to express support of a foreign government or to criticize the government, the flag, the Constitution, the military, you name it. Empowered by these things, law enforcement began raiding groups associated with any kind of radical politics. These raids were undertaken by a new police force, the Bureau of Investigation, later renamed the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or as we know it, the FBI. In 1919, the FBI raided a labor union called the Union of Russian Workers, arresting 1,182 people without warrants. One man named Nikolai Melikov later testified that the officers had used undue violence in the raid, saying, quote, "Outside of the classroom, there were two detectives standing, and everyone that passed out from the room was beaten. I was struck on my head, and being the last one to go out, was attacked by one detective, who knocked me down again, sat on my back, pressed me down to the floor with his knee, and bending my body back until blood flowed out of my mouth and nose. After this, I was thrown downstairs, where I fell with my head down to the ground floor."
Following the example of this raid, the FBI worked with local police departments to execute a series of raids across the country during the late fall and early winter of 1919 to 1920, known collectively as the Palmer Raids. They rounded up thousands of foreign nationals and radicals, arrested people without warrants, and detained them in overcrowded jails. To get information from arrested radicals, agents and police sometimes turned to violence. In New York City, Italian immigrant Gaspar Canon was arrested without a warrant and beaten by FBI agents in an attempt to get him to reveal information about a bombing. When he refused to sign a statement, the officers forged his signature. Through the following decades, the FBI and police routinely disrupted peaceful political gatherings of anarchists, communists, and socialists around the country. In 1931, the LAPD interrupted a gathering in the Los Angeles Philharmonic building using gas bombs and clubs. In January 1932, the height of the Great Depression, officers interrupted a gathering of unemployed people by hitting attendees with clubs, slingshots, and brass knuckles. Such attacks on communist and socialist gatherings continued until the mid-1960s, argues historian Reagan Schmidt, during the McCarthy years, while the federal government used Congress to root out communists, police and FBI turned their violent attention to the civil rights movement and anti-war movements.
We all know that police violence played a huge role in the civil rights movement, particularly in moments where large numbers of activists gathered in marches or demonstrations. In fact, some of the most famous photographs of the civil rights movement are images of police dogs attacking teenagers in the Birmingham Children's March. And yes, the Birmingham police used dogs against literal children in a peaceful march. So just let that sit with you for a moment. Notorious Commissioner of Public Safety in Birmingham, Bull Connor, thought dogs were a particular strength of his police force. He was quite proud of them, saying, quote, Dogs have been of invaluable assistance to us here in keeping down violence in connection with the racial demonstration. Dogs were used almost exclusively against Black protests, recalled an NAACP organizer in the mid-1960s. According to historian Tyler Wall, the, quote, specter of disorderly Black mobs certainly galvanized many police dog units, and at various times, the elderly, children, and even pregnant women were bitten. The police in Jackson, Mississippi, after whites attacked Black students staging a sit-in at a public library, and this resulted in large demonstrations, borrowed two police German shepherds to use in crowd control. A newspaper reported, excitedly, that the dogs were trained by Harry Neuwirth, quote, the former Nazi stormtrooper who trained killer Dobermans to guard Hitler's airport.
What the fuck? What the fuck? Right.
Exactly.
I don't understand.
And the newspaper was like, aren't we lucky to have gotten these dogs who were trained by this very good dog trainer who was a Nazi? Like, oh my god, I'm sorry, I just like that quote. Even when I was typing it, I was like, I don't even have words. Just incredible. I think it's no accident that slave patrols and fugitive hunters were notorious for using specially trained bloodhounds to track immobilized escaping enslaved people, as in the example that we gave earlier, and that police dogs are later disproportionately used against Black protesters, right?
Police and federal agents were also deeply invested in destabilizing and disrupting later civil rights movements, using surveillance and sabotage, such as the COINTELPRO program, targeted harassment and arrests for the petty crimes and outright violence. Of course, credible theories exist that the FBI was involved in the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. In the wake of King's murder, grieving protesters broke out in uprisings across the nation. In Chicago, an uprising was met with both the Chicago police and the National Guard. But the police response was criticized, not because it had resulted in violence, but because it wasn't violent enough. Citizens called for rioters to be shot on sight. Quote, no decent person wants looting. All over the world, the orders shoot to kill all looters has always been the only effective deterrent to this dastardly crime, end quote. As a result of the criticism to his response, Chicago Mayor Richard Daley ordered his police department that in the future, they were to shoot to kill anyone lighting fires and shoot to maim or cripple those suspected of looting.
Like, we're looting.
Yeah, I don't understand. Like, I mean, it's not a good thing. It does damage to property and, you know, hurts small business owners. But like, that's literally nothing compared to murder. Like, I don't even really understand. Yes. Like, I don't.
Exactly.
The only way that makes sense to you is if you don't value certain lives as much as you value your business.
Right. You know? And certain businesses. Right. And looting in itself is a form of protest, right? Like, nobody's looting if there isn't already a significant social disruption, right? Like, that's why looting goes along with riots. I just don't get it. I'm like, burn everything down, basically.
I mean, I don't get it either. I don't understand that mindset. I just don't understand.
Right.
Probably the reason why we're so having such a reaction to it is because we saw similar things to this, you know, during the George Floyd protests and where people were like, just kill those motherfuckers or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at it like, what the hell? Like, looting is like no big deal compared to just murdering, summarily killing people. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
We're talking about property crimes.
Yeah.
Those aren't capital crimes.
Right.
Like, nobody would get the death penalty for stealing diapers. Right. Like, it just makes zero sense to me. And even this quote, the order shoot to kill all looters has always been the only effective deterrent to this dastardly crime. What are you talking about? What is dastardly about it?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't get it.
Stealing stuff. Like, okay. We just like shoot people who like steal, I don't know, TVs or something under normal circumstances. Like, when I worked at Lowe's, I should have been armed so I could just, like, shoot people who stole, I don't know, screws or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the people who say that stuff are just pretending that it's not about race. You know what I mean? And there's, I don't know if you've seen that video of the, there was, like, an Asian woman who had a store who, like, a little girl was going to buy something and they decided not to. And the Asian woman thought she stole something, so she just shot her in the back of the head and killed her. And she was like,
oh my
she
God.
Was like 12. You haven't seen that? That video goes around.
No.
And it's, and you know, like, no. We, and her defense was like, oh, well, I thought that the girl stole something. And it's sort of like, so? Right. Like, so?
Exactly.
Like, is right. The, you know, I don't understand. And the only way that you can reconcile those behaviors is if you value other lives less than you value your own. Because I know for a fact that that lady wouldn't shoot her own kid for stealing a gum or whatever. You know what I mean? So right. It's just right. Nuts to yeah. Me. I don't get it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's grotesque. So Mayor Daley's directive to shoot to kill anyone lighting fires and shoot to maim or cripple those suspected of looting was tested later that same year when the Democratic National Convention was held in Chicago, bringing with it large numbers of leftists protesting the Vietnam War and the failings of the Democratic Party. Daley tried to prevent large gatherings in the first place by refusing to provide permits for demonstrations and parades and by ordering the police to strictly enforce a curfew and increase patrols. Normally, around 6,000 officers roamed the city at any one time. This, however, increased to 11,900, working 12-hour shifts to ensure maximum manpower. And this was before anything even happened. So suffice it to say, the police were primed for action when protesters actually started to do stuff, like take down an American flag in a park. So again, we're talking about, like, not a serious infraction here, right? Like, a protester took down an American flag that was on display, but police responded to that by beating the young man, which in turn made a crowd gather and start to chant anti-police and anti-war slogans. And then to disperse the crowd, the police used tear gas and began beating those who didn't leave the park quickly enough. In other words, the police use of force created a riot where there wasn't one before, right? Like they were the ones that created the problem that they were afraid was going to take place.
Right.
And then, of course, there just is no question that the next year, the Chicago Police Department killed Fred Hampton, the 21-year-old rising star of the Black Panther Party, in 1969 after breaking down his apartment door and opening fire on the sleeping residents inside.
Including his pregnant girlfriend.
Correct. Correct. They were in bed. They were
in bed. And if you've seen the photos of what their apartment looked like, there was hundreds of rounds all in the wall and stuff. It was insane.
Yes. Yeah. No, they were murdered. I mean, there's just no other argument to make. And so in the late 1960s, police used this violence against political radicals in the pursuit of law and order, quote unquote, law and order.
Mm-hmm. So in the late 20th century, another group was at the mercy of violent police, LGBTQ people. The shared experience of police brutality served as a point of connection between the Black Panther Party and LGBTQ people in California. In 1969, a leaflet distributed at a BPP conference in Oakland, California, read, "Vice pigs in Los Angeles beat a homosexual to death a few months ago. In Berkeley, vice pigs shot and murdered another homosexual in his own car. In Oakland, a straight professor the pigs thought was queer was beaten and later died. The homosexual revolution is part of the whole street revolution fighting fascism in the U.S. By locking arms with our brothers and sisters in the movement, we can all win our freedom. Power to the people." End quote. According to historian Jared Layton, this referred to three police murders: Howard Eflin, a Black gay man killed by the police in Los Angeles, Frank Bartley, a white gay man killed by police in Berkeley, and Philip Kaplan, a white heterosexual man police presumed to be gay, killed by officers in Oakland. Each of these people was killed when police were patrolling men soliciting consensual sex in public hookup locations, such as hotels or restrooms.
It seems like we know somebody who just wrote a book about that sort of.
I know.
Culture.
I was going to say this is like her wheelhouse.
Exactly.
Howard Eflin had been beaten to death by police who later claimed they were trying to arrest him for public lewdness with another man in the hotel. But later, the hotel clerk argued that Eflin was alone and his companion hadn't even checked into the hotel yet. Frank Bartley, an activist for the Society for Individual Rights, a gay rights organization, was entrapped into soliciting sex by an undercover officer. During the arrest, he was shot in the head. Philip Kaplan was a straight, white, married, leftist professor who was killed while police arrested him for what they argued was public masturbation in a bathroom stall. They later denied the police had beaten him, but that Kaplan had died because he injured himself while trying to get out of his handcuffs, which makes not much sense at all. Gay people were at high risk for violent policing, explained one columnist in a newsletter called Gay Sunshine. All of us are unapprehended felons. In 1970, the LAPD shot a black trans woman named Laverne Turner after an undercover officer picked her up in order to arrest her for selling sex. Police argued that Turner panicked when she realized that she was going to be arrested and had shot at officers. But witnesses at the scene stated that Turner was running away from the police when she was shot.
The path-breaking oral history, Boots of Leather, Slippers of Gold, by Madeline Davis and Elizabeth Kennedy, about lesbian life and culture in Buffalo during the 1950s, also documents the ways that the Buffalo police harassed and brutalized gay men and women in public spaces. One woman, named Peary, told Kennedy and Davis, quote, "To me, back in the 50s, being gay was brutal. I don't know how it was at the time for whites. I think it was worse for blacks being gay. Because I've got a brother that's gay, too, and he wore women's clothes. Like, on weekends and stuff, he'd go out and he'd be dressed, and the cops would lay some brutal beatings on him, you know? I mean, they used to beat him, throw him in jail, and sometimes he'd get away from them, and sometimes he wouldn't. And it was really just chaos then. And, like, I have been stopped. I was ready to go upstairs, me and two other girls. And the police station was right on the next block, and they walked up, poked us in the back. They, like, hit us in the back with their nightsticks. Okay, this is her saying what the police said. Okay, you racial slur. Walking the streets all times of the night, they took us to jail. And I was right on the corner where I live at, right? Another black lesbian named Lonnie was repeatedly arrested for no cause while standing on a street corner. Quote, "They treated me cold, very cold and cruel, very much so. Got hit in the stomach. I'll never forget it. That's why I don't like cops. I hate them. I'd rather die than go to the police to help me. I mean that. It hasn't changed much. If you're not going to be a racial slur, you're going to be a bull dyke." She's saying, like, what the police would say to her or what the police would think about her, right? If you're not going to be a, quote, racial slur, you're going to be a bull dyke. And I hate those words. I'm a lady lover myself.
With the war on drugs and the political rallying cry of law and order came an influx of cash for police departments and an increase in active policing around the United States. This was disproportionately aimed at black Americans who were regularly stopped for impromptu searches or approached for petty crimes in the hopes of finding evidence of drugs. One such person was Rodney King. The police attack on King would bring the reality of police brutality to the nation's attention in a way that almost no other incident had to this point. King was black and 25 years old, struggling his entire life with alcoholism and drug addiction. In the spring of 1991, King and two friends were speeding and driving recklessly on the way home after watching a basketball game with friends. A California Highway Patrol car tried to pull them over, but King sped up and tried to get away without pulling over.
I'm going to interrupt to say the police officers in that California Highway Patrol car were married to each other. Like, it's a husband and wife that are patrolling together. And, like, nothing that I read said anywhere that this seems really weird to me. I don't know. There's something about that just seems inappropriate. I don't know why. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't know things about police. But it seems wildly inappropriate.
Right, it does, because it seems like it would totally change the sort of calculus you have to do about, like, protecting your partner and stuff if they're, like, your married
exactly.
Your spouse. Yeah, that does seem really weird.
Exactly, yeah.
They called in backup, and several additional police cars entered the chase, including officers from the LAPD.
When they finally pulled King over, they ordered him and his passengers to get out of the car and lay on the ground. Almost immediately, the police started to use force. According to Douglas Linder, a law professor who used to blog about famous trials in American history, the police were frightened of King because he seemed, quote, spaced out, or in other words, high. One of the officers began to suspect that, quote, King was dusted, a user of the drug most feared by police departments, PCP. Police believed that the drug made individuals impervious to pain and gave them almost superhuman strength. And I want to sort of edit how Douglas Linder wrote this and say, like, they believed that the drug made black people impervious to pain and gave them superhuman strength, right? It's a drug that's associated with black men in particular. As a result, the police felt it necessary to use overwhelming force. They shot King with a taser, but after he failed to stay on the ground, they started beating him with batons, at first taking turns using what they later described as power strokes, which I guess is sort of like a tactic that they learn, which are sharp, hard strikes followed by stopping and stepping back, sort of like hitting and stepping back and seeing if like that one strike did the job, I guess. But when King still seemed to attempt to stand, the officers swarmed around him, beating him continuously with batons. While they were beating King, an officer threatened his friend and passenger, Freddie Helms, saying, quote, "You want to end up like your homeboy?" Little did the police officers know that across the street, a man named George Halliday picked up his camcorder and started shooting video of the beating. Later, he offered the tape to the police, but when they expressed no interest in it, he gave the tape to LA television station KTLA, who then aired the tape. It's wild to me. Today, the police would snatch up that tape so fast.
I know. And that's what I was thinking.
They
like,
would never see the light of day.
Poor choice on their part.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sort of thankfully, I guess, but still.
Right. Exactly. Like, we're glad that KTLA got that tape, but still, it's just wild to me. Like, today, the LAPD would be like, yep, we'll take that, thanks, and then throw it immediately into, like, the incinerator. The fact that the beating was caught on film and then disseminated took what would have been just another incident of police brutality to the level of a national crisis. Four of the cops involved were ultimately charged and tried for excessive use of force, but in April 1992, all four were acquitted. Almost immediately, Los Angeles descended into violent chaos as people protested the injustice of the jury's decision. The riots only teed up more conflict between the LAPD and black residents. Marissa, do you have any memory of this? You were a wee child.
I remember my parents talking about it. And it gives me some kind of reaction. I think that I've sort of blocked it out a little bit because my dad and my stepmom were, my stepmom was black and then my dad was white. And so they were in an interracial marriage. And this was at a time when it wasn't super acceptable, especially where they were. So I think like that race stuff like this was like really upsetting to them. And so I think that they talked about it, but also like, tried to protect me from that kind of stuff. But because I could see how upset all my parents were about it, I do remember it. And I can almost kind of remember seeing scenes on TV too. Can you remember it?
Yeah. It's really interesting. I really don't remember it clearly. It's actually funny. The first like big news event that I remember, I mean, I do remember really vaguely seeing video of, watching the news with my grandparents and seeing video of, what the hell is it called? Operation Desert Storm, which would have been not too long separated from this, but I don't remember seeing footage of this at all. I don't remember watching anything about it on the news. But what I do remember is later on, and of course, as a kid, this felt like, you know, it felt like ancient history, but I was like in high school and remember those shows that were like, I love the 80s and I love the 90s.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about? That were on VH1. There was one, I think it was I Love the 90s. And I was even watching this in like 2002 or 2003, right? And there was footage on it of the Rodney King, the riots. And I remember, and I think part of it too, they showed like footage of the beating. And I remember being like utterly flabbergasted and just being like, why do I not know anything about this? I don't know why that stands out to me so much, but it felt like, oh, this happened so, so long ago. And now I think about it, I'm like, oh my God, that was 10 years.
Right. After, before you had seen it.
Yeah. Right. Like it, right. Right. Like, but I mean, like it felt like, oh, this was ancient history. And like, it wasn't, it was like, it had not happened that long ago. Right. But yeah, it's for being such a huge event. I really do not have many memories of it. And I wonder if, maybe my parents just didn't have the television on or something like that in order to sort of like protect us from those kind of images. But I really do not have clear memories of it at all.
I kind of remember like, because I had older step siblings too, who were like adults at that point, who were young adults. And like, I sort of remember this. I don't remember exact conversations, but I kind of remember this feeling of like, hey, we've been trying to tell you all this forever, that kind of thing. Like this sort of, that's like, this is not news. Yeah. If you're Black in America, none of this is news. You know what I mean? Kind of thing. And the sort of interest in the fact that mainstream white America like saw this as news and saw it as some kind of like revelation or something.
Exactly.
That's sort of like the feeling that I have, because I can remember that feeling coming back after the George Floyd protests. And I remember that sort of same. Yeah, that sort of same conversation or that same dialogue. Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
Right.
The Rodney King beating. It made police brutality visible to Americans who otherwise had the privilege of being unaware of the realities of policing in the United States. But while people may have been shocked, most white middle-class Americans had their sensibilities offended by the rioting and were able to justify police actions with racist theories about criminality and drug use. King was high. He was breaking the law. He was a threat to others. He was resisting arrest. While people have certainly been harmed and indeed killed at the hands of police between 1992 and 2015, the issue came raging back into the public consciousness with the high-profile police murders of Michael Brown, Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, George Floyd, and Breonna Taylor, with periodic outbreaks of riot and uprising, especially in connection with other aspects of structural racism in the United States, such as Confederate iconography.
And, like, to be clear, I only... You know, we mentioned those particular names because they are some of the names that created like kind of the biggest national conversations. But that is not to say that they are the only people killed or harmed by the police during this time period. Right. There are dozens more. We just don't have the time or the capability to give space to all of the conversations there that we should be having. And of course, there are lots of different kinds of continuities in history, as evidenced by this series, right? But the more I read for this episode, the more I found it striking and incredibly depressing and demoralizing that police brutality is just simply woven into the fabric of the United States. In fact, in the time that I was reading and preparing for this episode, a woman here in Western New York was killed by the police. So it is a constant experience in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's kind of inextricably linked with our culture. Mm-hmm. I also spent a lot of time, not totally related to this episode, but just, you know, partly as some like light YouTube viewing while I've been grading and stuff. I've been watching a YouTube series by a YouTuber, oh gosh, I need to give him credit. Hold on, I need to figure out what his name is. Hold on. Stay with me. Don't leave. I've been watching a series of YouTube video essays by a YouTuber whose name is Skip Intro on copaganda. Like, television shows.
Wait, you think this person's name is Skip Intro?
Well, it's not their name. It's their YouTube channel name, right? Skip Intro. I don't know what his actual name is. I'm not, like, I know how YouTube works. I'm not that old. But this series, I really recommend it. It's been so eye-opening. Just about, like, not only is police brutality sort of baked into our society and culture, but like police work really, really hard, and they work with media to create public trust in the institution. And one of the reasons they have to do that is because otherwise nobody would trust the police. Why should we trust the police? Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have shows like Paw Patrol, that are created, well, to sell toys, but also to create from a young age a sense that the police are there to help you, even though, you know, it's not uncommon for when you call the police for them to kill you or kill your dog or steal your property or any number of other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So feel free to cut this out, but also ACAP.
Why would I cut that out?
That's sort of where I'm at the end of this.
Yeah, it's really hard not to feel that way, because, you know, you can make as many common sense, like, oh, police need better training, or like, we just need to demilitarize or whatever. You can like make as many really reasonable sounding moderate arguments as you want about it. But when you look at the historical continuity, it is really hard to imagine any other way to make policing work without completely destroying the institution as it is now and rebuilding and having it be totally different. Like, it's really hard to imagine, because, you know, there's just so many facets of it that are like customary and habitual, you know, that are viewed as benign, but are actually kind of one, like, some of the root causes of police brutality. But, you know, police themselves can't recognize that, can't see that, because they're inside of the institution. You know, it's just like, it's like a really hard question. And, you know, whenever I look at the history of these things, it makes me feel a little bit hopeless, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. On that very hopeful note, thank you for listening. And honestly, though, I mean, in all seriousness, thank you for engaging with this, right? Thank you for engaging with this material. It's dark, it's upsetting, it's horrible, but it's important. It's important to know this history. It's important to sit with it, even though it's not your sort of light, happy podcast listen. I think this stuff is really critical. And it was hard to do this research, but it was also rewarding in that I know that I'll be, it'll be something that I'll be better able to teach and incorporate into classes in the future.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, I think people who disagree with aspects of this, or you know, people who know law enforcement or who respect law enforcement, you know, it's just as important for people like that to really think about this and sit with this and really meditate about what this means. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know how many Thin Blue Line listeners we have, probably very few, but, you know, I hope that people... Those are the people that I think can really like benefit from learning these stories and learning about historical continuity. But I suspect definitely. They might be the people who don't make it to the end of the episode. So we'll see.
Right. Yeah. Well, we can hope that, you know, that just engage with it. You don't have to agree with all of it, but I will also say that, you know, I didn't make any of this stuff up.
Right.
You can feel your reaction is yours to control, but this is all history. Mm-hmm. It is history, right?
Yeah.
So you can dislike it, but it's true.
Yeah, and it's and these are not anyway. Only Sarah's interpretations. It's the interpretations of dozens of you know really well respected historians who are using documentary evidence in really ethical ways, right? So it's
yes,
you have to think about it that way too.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Want me to do this bit at the end? I'll do it.
Sure. Go for it.
As always, we invite you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at @dig_history, or join our Facebook group, Dig History Pod Squad. You should also follow us on TikTok. If you have a comment or question or want to share some kind words with us, you can always email us at hello@digpodcast.org. We love listener mail. We send it to all four of us and we're all like, ooh, I love it. And we, if you're an educator, we've got a compendium of episodes you can use in the classroom and free teaching resources, including full lesson plans on our website, digpodcast.org. We realize that recent changes to curriculum in states like Florida and Texas will complicate being able to use our podcast episodes in the classroom. So please reach out if there's something we can do to be helpful to you and your classroom. You'll also find full bibliographies, the scripts of all our episodes, resources, and a link to our swag store at digpodcast.org. And don't forget to pre-order Spiritualism's Place now at Three Hills Press or wherever you buy books.
Woohoo!
Bye! And if any such slaves should sell... And if any... Oh my god, this is a lot of S's. Blah, blah. And if any...
Slave patrols... Oh, that was loud.
Slave patrols! I know.
Notorious Commissioner of Public Safeting... Oh my god, safeting.
And LGBTQ2... LGBTQ2. Oh my god, I'm going insane. Undercover officer. This is like a 500 clause sentence. Can you help me here? I don't even know what the hell's going on.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.